Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Aldo Leopold is a name that's not all that well known, but for people who love true wilderness or even a sportsman who loves to hunt and fish, Leopold is the man responsible for the practices behind contemporary wildlife management, and he's considered the father of the American wilderness movement. He articulated the idea of the land ethic, a way of thinking and acting towards the land that recognizes the inherent value of the land in its natural state. Well, my guest today is Tennessee-based storyteller Jim Fitzer, who's created a one-man show about Leopold titled A Standard of Change. In it, Fitzer portrays Leopold as he comes back 67 years after his death to his beloved Wisconsin shack, which was a dilapidated old farm he rehabilitated as a natural area during his last years. There, he explores the effects of human progress on wilderness and wild places and reflects on his own transformation on how we should manage nature and wilderness. A Standard of Change is presented by the Oxley Nature Center and the Oklahoma Humanities Council and takes place this Saturday at 2:30 at the Hardesty South Regional Library. It's free to the public. Jim Fitzer is a well-known storyteller who tells stories about his interactions with nature, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Jim Fitzer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Good to be here.
You know, we think of wildlife conservationists, we often think of John Muir or Teddy Roosevelt, mm-hmm. sort of the founders of that first ethos of preservation of the wild. But we don't often think of, and many of us have never even heard, of Aldo Leopold. Who was Aldo Leopold and why was he important?
Well, he was extremely important. In fact, I like to say that he was the most important conservationist of the 20th century that most people have never heard of. Born in Burlington, Iowa, 1887, he was greatly influenced by his father from a young age. He was a sportsman. And they would go out hunting in the age of market hunting, in the age of no limits. And his father taught him to have more respect for the land, to hunt sustainably. And so he started developing a special ethic, and his time was spent in the outdoors. That's what he did. If he wasn't hunting, he was bird watching. He was keeping meticulous journals of all the things going on around him in the woods and what flower was blooming when and what birds were nesting where. And it only made sense when he came of age to try to study these things. But at that point in time, the only real course of study would have been forestry. He went to the Yale School of Forestry, the first accredited forestry program in the country, and went on from there to work down in the New Mexico Territory with the Forest Service. From there, he made quite an amazing mark, had an up-and-down career. But the thing he's best known for is the book that he finished just before his death in 48, wasn't published until 49, a year later, which is the Sand County Almanac. And that's not the only thing he wrote, but that's a collection of essays that that he's best known for.
It really sort of helped push ahead the preservation movement and the wilderness movement. In fact, he sort of coined the idea of a wilderness.
He did. He spoke back in the early 20s of roadless pack country, he called it. And the result of that was the first ever designated wilderness in our country, the Gila Wilderness down in New Mexico, was entirely his brainchild, and he pushed that through. We just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Wilderness Act, 1964. And people talk about that being the beginning of wilderness in our country, but not so at all. Leopold was pushing for this idea years prior, and who knows, without his work on the Gila, whether or not we would have the wilderness system as we know it today.
While he was in New Mexico, he sort of had a change in his vision. He went from the sort of conservationist in which you preserve wild things so that man can benefit from it to a sort of more of a viewpoint of preserving wild things because they are wild and we need wild things in our lives.
Well, that's at the heart of what some consider to be his greatest work, the land ethic. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the land ethic is that the kind of ethical relationship we have with people, which he would say involves love, respect, admiration, we value each other philosophically. In other words, the fact that you exist, Rich, I give you value. He argued that we needed to have that same kind of relationship with the land, and that means the soils, the air, the water, the plants, the animals. And this was a fairly new concept.
Radical, and especially in the Forest Service in those days, because the Forest Service was really about managing resources for public benefit, but also as a cash product?
There were basically two missions of the Forest Service in those days, and that was managing the forest for board feet of timber and for game. And, of course, Leopold found fairly quickly that a lot of the things we were doing to try to manage the land for both was really destroying both. Especially, he oversaw predator extirpation programs where we were trying to kill off all of the wolves and all of the mountain lions.
And black bear, too.
And the bears. In fact, he oversaw the killing of the last grizzly bear in Arizona and wrote a beautiful, heart-wrenching essay about that that's in a Santa County Almanac.
And at some point, he changed his thinking from overseeing that program to actually leading efforts to manage those large predators in a wild setting or even in the national forest.
That's right. And he made a lot of enemies over the years because of his changes in policy. You know, when you've been saying we have to kill all the predators, he wrote at one point that we would not have success until the last lion and wolf in New Mexico were killed. And then, you know, 20 years later, he's saying we need to reintroduce predators. So you can imagine, I mean, even late in life, he was still making enemies from the people that were his people, you know, the hunters, the sportsmen.
You mentioned he sort of had an up and down career with the Forest Service. Was that because of it? Because his views were evolving, or was he just a rascal sort of person that sort of his opinion was the right way and everybody else was be hanged?
There certainly was a degree of that. He came right out of the gate as a cocky young fellow, 22 years old, going into the Forest Service, managing crews that were going out to measure the Carson National Forest. And he completely ignored the experience of his elders who were out there working with him and completely fell on his face, almost lost his job over it, in fact. And so took a long time to recover. By the time he started recovering from that just a little bit, he became deathly sick with nephritis. The result of his working too hard, pushing too hard to try to come back, led him to having to go home for a couple of years to Iowa to recuperate on his mother's couch. So everything was up and down and up and down. But throughout all of that, the thing he never stopped doing was thinking. Mm-hmm. Aldo Leopold never took anybody's word for anything. And so he was always pushing new ideas and changing his own ideas. At the heart of the play that I'm performing here, which we haven't even gotten to yet, I look at his relationship with Albert Hochbaum, who was first one of his graduate students at the University of Wisconsin, later became a brilliant scientist in his own right. Hochbaum really pushed Leopold to, as he put it in one of his letters, get off your pedestal. He said, you know, you're preaching things that are at odds with what you've always represented, and you're right. Problem is, you come across as some kind of sage who is never despoiled. You need to admit to the readers that you have blood on your hands.
Well, let's talk about this one-man show. Now, you're a storyteller. This was sort of a departure for you to actually do a play, a standard of change. It's a story of Aldo Leopold, and you can take us through the narrative, if you will. But how did this project get started?
Well, back in my 20s, I started telling stories. And as soon as I realized that I had a market for that, that people would actually hire me to do it, I knew I needed to do something with Aldo Leopold. I had discovered his book in my teens. It was my constant companion, changed my life in a lot of ways. The problem is his writing is so poetic, so beautiful, that I was terrified to touch it because I knew that I couldn't recreate it in my own language, and I didn't believe that I could ever memorize his work, so I didn't know what to do. This stayed with me for years and years and years until I was in my mid-40s. And that's when finally due to a downturn in the economy and the storytelling work dropping off, I sold my house. I was kind of lost. I said, well, this is a good time to embark on this project I've been thinking about for years. And I started researching deeper and deeper into Leopold. And it took about a year of writing and researching. I got the cooperation of the Leopold Foundation up in Wisconsin. A lot of visits to them to dig into the archives. But it took almost a year before I realized that, oh, my God, I've written something that isn't a story for me to tell. It's a play that I must act. And that terrified me. I almost quit at that point because I'd never acted before, never memorized a story. But something kept me going. I guess probably I didn't have anything else going on. Might as well give it a try. And it's working.
So the device I think you use for the play is that Aldo Leopold comes back after his death, right? And
yes.
And sort of seeing what things are today. I mean, obviously, I would think he would be pleased by some things and seriously distressed by others.
Of course.
You know, the Wilderness Act took place, what it would be, almost 15, 16 years after his death. Mm-hmm. And now there's millions and millions of acres that are preserved. He would be obviously happy about that.
Of course. And that's a big part of his legacy that he quite frequently doesn't get enough credit for. But you're right. It is, in essence, it's a ghost story. I have a man who died 67 years ago showing up today. And when he does show up, you can imagine seeing a landscape that he began shaping back in the 30s and 40s, now having matured, blossomed, he's able to see what worked and what didn't work. I also have him just thinking back on some of his most important essays and how he came to write those, why he came to write those. At the heart of it is this relationship with Albert Hochbaum that I mentioned, who put a lot of pressure on him. But I think at the real heart of the play is the intersection of human progress and wildness. I think anybody who's working on conservation issues has to deal with those two things intersecting all the time. How do we continue to push forward as a people and do what's right by the resources that are around us and that we rely on? And so I have him facing some of the challenges, both the goods and the bads, the things he struggled with, the things that almost knocked him down, and the things that he can be proud of today.
When I heard this scenario, I was thinking, again, of the good and bad things. Obviously, the Wilderness Act would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think of the sprawl in the western United States,
yeah,
where even in our lifetimes, you know, things that were once empty land is now subdivisions, and even well into the foothills of the mountains, sometimes butting up to wilderness areas, mm-hmm, or protected areas where, you know, you can literally see where the border is because development stops.
That's right. And Leopold was experiencing this in his day as well. In fact, after he headed east to go to boarding school, he came back home and saw that the swamps across the Mississippi River on the Illinois side of the river from his home in Burlington, Iowa, the swamps had been drained for development and for farming. And he wrote that the community found itself enriched by this. He came back and immediately felt impoverished by it. Now, this is coming from a kid of 18 years old, you know.
Late in his life, after he retired from the Forest Service, he sort of set up an experiment on his own family farm. I think he bought a farm and that had been sort of run down, and he basically tried to rebuild it as a sustainable, small little patch of ecosystem.
Right, he did. And, of course, he never really came to a point of retirement.
He died fighting a grass fire.
He did. He was only 61 when he passed away, and because of some health issues, he could no longer do the field work that he had done with the Forest Service. He went through a few different career changes. He worked at the Forest Products Laboratory in Wisconsin. He did a huge research study for the ammunition industry of game in the Midwest and was being asked by other organizations all over the country to do similar surveys in different regions. Didn't do it. But while at Wisconsin, he was asked to start the first ever wildlife management program at the University of Wisconsin. So he literally wrote the book on wildlife management. At that point, it was called Game Management. It then evolved into wildlife management. While he was there, he found a 120-acre property on the Wisconsin River, about an hour drive, well, nowadays an hour drive, probably a two-hour drive back then north of Madison near Baraboo. This property had been farmed until there was just nothing left. His daughter called it, I believe, a sea of cockleburr as far as the eye could see. And he chose that land largely because it was so run down. He was able to buy it for the back taxes that were owed on it. The original farmhouse had long since burned. The only thing left was an old chicken coop, which his one of his other daughters referred to as being waist deep in chicken manure.
Mm-hmm.
They shoveled out the chicken manure and added a fireplace and a second little L off of it where they could have some sleeping bunks, and that became their place to get away on weekends. He would hunt there. He would experiment on restoration. And it was there where he did the first ever prairie restoration. People didn't believe that we could restore the land after it had been destroyed. He proved otherwise. He, at the same time, he was restoring a prairie at the Arboretum at the University of Wisconsin, you know, south of there. And that is where the play is set. I have him walking down the path towards that. It's affectionately called the Shack now. It's now a National Historic Landmark, so a very special place.
My guest today is Jim Fitzer, a Tennessee-based storyteller. He'll be doing his one-man show, A Standard of Change, presented by the Oxley Nature Center, this Saturday at 2:30 at the Hardesty South Regional Library. The program's also being supported by the Oklahoma Humanities Council, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. So, as you said, you set this at the Shack. It's 68 years later. Would he recognize the place today?
Well, the Shack is largely unchanged, especially now as a National Historic Landmark. It can't be significantly changed, and I've had the great fortune of being able to spend a few nights in it while I was researching, and that was a truly magical time. But the landscape, he hardly would recognize, because he planted nearly 40,000 pines there in his attempts to restore the land. They were 10 feet tall at his death. Now they tower over our heads.
Would not recognize it in a good way?
He would not recognize it in a very good way.
What about the area surrounding this National Historic Site? Is it also a landscape he would recognize, or has it changed utterly over those 60 years?
Well, it certainly has changed a lot. There's now an interstate running fairly close by. It was a very quiet place when he was there.
Right.
He would not like hearing those cars. But one thing the Leopold Foundation has done, it's a foundation his five children started back in the 70s, is they have either purchased outright or are jointly managing hundreds of acres around it to try to preserve and or restore what was there in Leopold's time. So a lot of that marsh around there, he would recognize and would be very pleased that it's continued to be be managed.
Now you mentioned earlier he was also sort of the father of the wildlife management, and of course that has taken off greatly, not only for the benefit of people who want to preserve wildness, but also for sportsmen and hunters and fishermen and the like. What were some of his ideas in that area, his innovations in managing wildlife in that way?
Well, first off, as I mentioned before, he pulled back the reins from looking at board feet of timber and as much game as we can
shoot,
have. He realized that a balanced ecosystem meant something very different. And for instance, in his day, sportsmen considered it unethical to shoot does. You know, you only shot the bucks. Well, Leopold saw that if you shoot a buck, there's plenty of other bucks to create more fawns.
Right.
If you shoot a doe, that doe doesn't reproduce that year. And his fellow sportsmen came down very hard on him for that. But he said, if we're going to manage this sustainably, we have to start hunting does. We need to start reintroducing the predators that we got rid of. In his essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, which really is the essay that inspired me from the very beginning, he lays out a picture of what happens when you get rid of all the predators. He said, a buck pulled down by wolves can be replaced in 2 or 3 years, but a range pulled down by too many deer may fail of replacement in as many decades.
Hmm.
So that was a big thing, recognizing that, you know, he thought if fewer wolves meant more deer, then no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But that just didn't work. You ended up with a starving deer herd. And that's a lot of what we have today. We have either starving deer herds or we have deer herds that are overrunning everything and we can't hunt them fast enough. We found out that we cannot, as hunters, pressure them in the same ways or hard enough that wolves or mountain lions would. And that, again, there you get into that human progress versus wildness. Do you want wolves and mountain lions in your backyard?
No.
So how do we manage these things?
But I think it also is also incumbent on us to know that there are places we probably shouldn't be living too. And there's an equally hard question there, because man loves to live in places where those predators would thrive.
That's right. We want to be in wild places, but we don't want them to be wild.
Yeah.
And that's a real dilemma.
Or too wild.
Right. A very tame wild.
You mentioned the essay Thinking Like a Mountain. How did that influence you in the writing of this piece?
Well, it really is at the heart of the play. I memorized that essay before I ever started working on the rest of the play, the rest of the story. When I got this book back in my teens, all of it moved me deeply. But it was that essay that really knocked me off my feet. And about 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago, when I hadn't really even thought about doing this yet, I got a call from a gentleman who ran a wilderness advocacy campaign in East Tennessee. He said, "Jim, we're doing a friendraiser, if you will. I want local celebrities in Chattanooga to come out and read from their favorite conservation writers. I'd like you to be the MC of the event." He said, "If you'd like, you could read an essay as well." And I said, "Well, I don't like reading in front of people. I prefer telling stories." He said, "Well, then you can recite one. What's your favorite essay?" And I said, "Well, that's easy. That's Thinking Like a Mountain by Aldo Leopold." He said, "Great, you can recite that." And he hung up the phone. He didn't give me a chance to say no. So I was faced with this decision of either calling him back and saying, "Hey, no, I can't do this," or taking it on. So I decided to take it on, found it easier to memorize than I thought, probably because I'd read it hundreds and hundreds of times at that point. And when I saw the looks in people's eyes at the end of that essay, when I saw tears on people's cheeks in the middle of that essay, I said, "I can't put off this Leopold thing any longer. I have to do something." The next day, I called the Leopold Foundation and said, "You know, can you work with me on this?" Now, they don't support me financially in any way, but they've been very cooperative, very supportive of the project. And basically, I had that essay, and I built the story around that essay.
And I assume that from the title, the viewpoint of the essay is we need to think for eons as opposed to a year, 10 years, 50 years down the road.
That's right. Leopold writes in there that only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of a wolf. I think he's right on. We are, by virtue of our lifespans, very short-sighted in ecological terms. The mountain's been around for a lot longer. I mean, it too will pass, and it hasn't been there forever, but it's been around long enough to see things objectively.
My guest today is Jim Fitzer. He's a Tennessee-based storyteller who will be presenting his one-man show on Aldo Leopold this Saturday at 2:30 at the Hardesty South Regional Library, presented by the Oxley Nature Center and the Oklahoma Humanities Council. It's titled A Standard of Change. Where does that title come from, A Standard of Change?
You know, I'm really proud of that title because as I was creating the play, you know, one of the challenges I mentioned before is his writing is so poetic. It's so beautiful. I can't do that justice. And so most of the play is his words directly from his essays or from his letters or from his friend Albert's letters back to him. I simply provide the connective tissue that puts it all together. And I'm very careful about not putting too many words in his mouth, although I do a little bit. And at some point, I don't know where that line came from, but I was thinking about Hochbaum had written a letter to Leopold in which he suggested that, let's see, his words were, he quoted Henry David Thoreau, who wrote in his essay Walking, "One would be a poet who would impress the winds and streams into his service to speak for him, deriving the words, transplanting them to the page with earth still adhering to their roots." But then he went on in that same letter to suggest to Leopold that he really was the guy better equipped to do that than John Muir ever was, which put a lot of pressure on him. And he told him that people didn't view Aldo Leopold as a person, but more of a standard. Hmm. And when I read that, I thought, well, what is that standard then? Hochbaum didn't say in the letter what the standard was. He simply said, you are more of a standard than a person. And as I looked at all of the things that he was trying to get across to Leopold, I realized it was about being willing to change, being open and honest about that change. I have him quoting Ralph Waldo Emerson in the play as well, who he was a big student of. He read these guys very thoroughly. And, you know, Emerson wrote that foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by philosophers and statesmen. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if that's the case, what's the opposite of that foolish consistency would be bold change. And so I decided that seemed to me to be the standard that he was setting. And it made a lot of friends and it made a lot of enemies. It continues to inspire people and anger people to this day.
Well, we look forward to the program this Saturday afternoon at the Hardesty South Regional Library. In our last couple of minutes, not only are you doing this play and have been doing this play, but your main livelihood is a storytelling. And I assume it's mm-hmm. about your own experiences. And it sounds like you've done all sorts of things out in nature. You're sort of a specimen of nature, I would think.
I suppose that's correct. I barely passed high school. Uh-huh. And so the logical thing was to go into college, right? So I went to study wildlife management, but immediately flunked out in the first semester. Spent my 20s wandering around, living in a Volkswagen bus, trying to figure out how I could do what I loved. And I worked as a rafting guide on the Snake River. I ran a hostel in Redwood National Park. I did a lot of educational programs for wildlife rehabilitation centers, working with injured and orphan birds of prey. And as you can imagine, all those types of works lead to storytelling. That's really what I was doing, was telling stories. And at some point in my mid-20s, I got a phone call from somebody saying, hey, would you come out and tell your bird stories? Because I'd written several true bird stories from my life, interactions I had as a child with trying to raise an owl in my bedroom. Or when I was 17, I went dove hunting and accidentally shot a kestrel, a little falcon.
Oh.
Devastated me. Also changed my life. So I was telling these stories as educational tools. Well, somebody called and said, would you come and tell these stories? And I said, well, I'd love to. And, you know, I do that with the birds. You need to call the rehab center, and they'll schedule it, and then you can just request me. And I said, no, we don't want the birds. We just want you to tell your stories. And I was blown away that they would want me without the birds. I couldn't imagine. But it worked. People loved it. And it's grown from there. So, yes, most of what I tell is personal stories. Most of them involve my relationship with the natural world, be it close encounters with black bears, be it, owls, whatever the case may be.
Mm. Now, you're also working on a new big story mm-hmm. of sorts, and it involves the Tennessee chestnut blight, moonshining, and I assume it's set all around your neck of the woods in East Tennessee.
That's right. The American chestnut blight hit in New York in the 20s. It came across the ocean, as so many of these invasive species
do. Everywhere.
Came across on Chinese chestnut trees. It took hold in the American chestnut. It doesn't usually kill the Chinese chestnut, but it devastated the American chestnut tree, which was a cornerstone of the economy and just life in general throughout Appalachia. The chestnuts fattened our hogs. The wood is what we built our fences and our barns with, because it lasts forever and ever and ever. It just doesn't rot. And we ground those nuts into flour. It was a staple for society. And the blight wiped it out in the late 20s, early 30s, when the Great Depression also hit. So we had people in the towns losing their jobs, trying to go back to the land, saying, well, as long as there's chestnut trees, a family can survive. Chestnut trees were gone. The people in the mountains who lost the chestnut trees went to the town saying, trees are gone, we need jobs. There were no jobs. Everything fell apart. And so I'm exploring the intersection of those things, and I've been delighted to find in my research that moonshining was a big part of it all, and that's now become a huge part of the story as well. And I can't wait to finish that. It'll be a few more months, I think, before it's ready for the stage.
All right. Well, I hope a lot of people come out to see Standard of Change Saturday at the Hardesty Library. Jim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Storyteller Jim Fitzer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll portray Aldo Leopold in his one-man show titled A Standard of Change, which will be presented Saturday afternoon at 2:30 at the Hardesty South Regional Library, presented by the Oxley Nature Center and the Oklahoma Humanities Council. Admission is free to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.